Yo, VIP. Let's kick it.
So, very fittingly, this week, during the polar vortex that overtook the United States of America, and some of Canada also, we actually read number 25, The Extreme, which features...
Well named.
It is. It features Marco morphing a polar bear on the cover as our kids take an unplanned trip to the Arctic. So everything felt very lined up in terms of weather outside and weather in the books that we were reading, and everything was just really, really, really cold. So we hope that you survived the blast of freakishly wintry weather and that you also enjoyed The Extreme, because we're here to talk about it with you. This book is very oddly structured, admittedly. Like, most of the book is spent surviving, which I feel like that happens more recently with the structure of the books, where like they receive a plan or like a threat, and then they assemble a plan to deal with the threat, and then when they're on the plan, something goes like horribly wrong, and then they have to just like try and cope with everything that went wrong, and then at the very end they like come up with some way to sort of like kind of meet their original like plan's goal as they escape with their lives intact.
I can't decide if I read this and was like, what happened? And I can't decide if that was because it was the first,
is the first ghost written book.
So I thought maybe, like, the writer was trying to really closely match K.A.'s style, or if they were trying to, like, differentiate from it. But overall, just, I don't know, it didn't really stick in my head, and it was kind of confusing. But
yeah.
Then, like, upon reflection, I really liked the introduction of the new aliens, just because I like aliens. So, and then, you know, that served to establish, like, more of what we know about the Yurks and their involvement with alien species and what they're willing to do, you know, to win their war. So that was cool, I guess.
Yeah.
Cool.
There were a couple things that, like, skirted into interesting territory, but I felt like thematically nothing really came together to make like a cohesive like emotional picture for the character. And this is a Marco book, and usually with Marco it's either like emotions at 100 or emotions are like, you know, on a low simmer.
This time emotions were like, Marco is a jerk more than usual. Like, the whole time I was reading, I was like, he's being kind of mean, like, even for him. It just seemed like he was being a dick to everyone.
Yeah.
For no real reason? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it was dialed up.
Well, a new ghostwriter, that probably explains that, is like a different interpretation of how to bring Marco into the narrative, especially when, and I feel like he can skew a little meaner when it's not his narration. I feel like this was a good, like, when it's his narration, it's an easy opportunity for us to be like with him and on his side and have him not seem really harsh, because we understand where he's coming from. But that, like, didn't really necessarily happen. And the thing, too, like, at the very beginning of the book, usually there's something in the beginning that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the book, and this was not one of those things. Like, it was just, like, a strange interlude through Marco Land, which, like, there was something that could have been interesting about it, like, the idea that he has a date with this girl named Marion, and they go to the, like, symphony, and he falls asleep and wakes up, and everyone's gone, including Marion. And so...
Ooh.
Yeah, but it raises the question, like, is Marion a controller? Can Marco trust her? What kinds of relationships can these kids have in the circumstances that they're in? Which I think is a worthwhile slash tragic, which is probably why it's worthwhile, pursuit to explore, because the answer is really complicated. And, like, Marco sort of was like, Cassie tells him that they followed Marion for a couple days, for 3 days, and... she reported, you know, she wasn't a controller, she didn't go anywhere near a Yurk pool, and Marco was like, oh, and didn't really know if he should feel relieved that she wasn't a controller, or if he should, like, be, a, like, pursue her again, or, like, try, like, it complicated things, and he didn't know if it was better or worse that she wasn't a controller, in terms of, like, trying to, like, date somebody. But that didn't go anywhere, like... That didn't go anywhere in the book, and it didn't, the question of who to let into your life, that wasn't raised again in the book thematically at all.
It kind of was,
oh.
But
Tell.
In a way that was totally, you know, effectively pointless with the Inuit kids.
That's right! That's right, right, right! Because they didn't...
He's probably my favorite character in the book.
I would second that.
Sorry, guys. He's really chill.
I would second that.
Oh, I've said it again. Okay, the point of this podcast is to work as many weather-related terms in the conversation as possible.
Yes!
So I have 2 points. Cool and chill so far.
Curses! I'm behind! Alright, I gotta catch up.
Okay. Yeah, what is his name?
Derek.
Derek, yes. Yeah, he's just like... But he doesn't really veer too much into that stereotype of like, oh yes, they're animal spirits. I mean, that's what he says, but he's also like, that's what my grandfather says.
Yeah.
So he's just kind of like a kid who sees something freaky and it's like,
and
okay.
They all just roll with it, though.
And then we never see him again because he lives in the fucking Arctic, so it's like, it doesn't matter if he sees them.
Yeah, and like...
That's what Marco says.
And it also, they don't really explore, like, that's sort of, the way they explain away how they just lay all their cards on the table with him is that because he lives in the Arctic, so it's like, eh. And it doesn't connect back to the thing with Marion, or it doesn't, like, I guess, like, you could consider it, like, foreshadowing from, like, books to come, but really it just kind of felt undercooked in that, like, area. They, like, could have done something there. And it made me want that, I, like, really wanted them to, like, I mean, they're not going to after the David saga, but I was like, Derek, like, honorary Animorph?
Yeah, he's so cool. And, I mean, this side, like, sidebar, this does kind of bring up the question of, could this series be written in the same way, like, if it were coming out right now? Because,
mm-hmm.
Let's face it, even if you live at the North Pole, you have a smartphone.
That's true.
Everyone has a smartphone now.
That's true.
So,
and plus it makes sense.
There's no more of that, like, distance, like, oh, we're safe because he can't tell anybody because, you know, nobody would believe him, A, and B, he lives in the middle of nowhere, like, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. And it makes sense, theoretically, if they're fighting, if, you know, they want to put up, like, a firm resistance, that theoretically they would want to expand and have, like, multiple places. I mean, especially if the Yerks are going to continue, like, doing stuff with the Venber, which we'll talk about them in a minute. Like, did the Animorphs really... I mean, they blew up the base, but the Yerks could build another one, like...
Yeah, and it was, like, it was definitely left open that they assumed that some of the Venber had survived.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they weren't all accounted for.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't concern you that there's aliens running around in the Arctic? Like, it doesn't matter that it's in the Arctic. There are humans around, obviously. Derek is there. The village or town or whatever is there. Like...
Yeah.
Not the middle of nowhere that much.
Yeah. Yeah, well, especially, like you said, in today's day and age. Like, it's definitely, like, nowhere is in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, even in the 90s, like, you know, we were rapidly approaching that point.
Yeah.
They have the internet in this book, even if it is AOL. So.
So the basic plot of this book was that after this Marion fiasco, Eric, the Chi, comes to them and tells them that the Yerks are using Earth's satellite technology, which you'd think they would already have because they're Yerks and they stole everything from the Andalites, and the Andalites are light years ahead of time,
yeah,
according to Axe.
Yeah, this seems like low-level, like, we're going to use Earth technology to do, like, you can fly through space!
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would make it easier, like, to be covert about it. Like, if you're using Earth's technology, it would be a lot easier. But so, regardless, they're going to use Earth satellite technology to beam Candrona rays into, like, swimming pools, essentially. Like, that would be the result. Which, sure, we'll just go with it. So...
It did make me wonder, and I don't remember if this was, like, established, but say they would it be targeted to like, people who are already controllers so that they don't have to, you know, so they have their own personal York pool, basically, or would it be literally every swimming pool and lake? Like, ever.
That would probably, the latter would probably be the end result, or the end goal.
Because, like, do Condorna rays do anything to species that aren't Yerks? Like, would it, like, change lake ecology?
I don't know.
Would it, like, fry your kids if they went swimming in your pool and they didn't have a Yerk in their head?
That is a good question. Yeah, because every time I think of a Yerk pool, I think of it filled with Yerks. Like, what is it like when there's nothing in there?
Oh. I mean, the word they usually use is viscous.
Ooh.
Which I would notice if my swimming pool
was viscous.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does. I feel like, I mean, this isn't the first time that the Yurks have tried to do something with Candrawn arrays where it makes each individual Yurk self-sufficient in terms of, like, getting their own Candrawn and not having to have the social structure where they have to go to the Yurk pool every 3 days, which is, like, suspicious and problematic. And inconvenient, probably. So regardless, they know from Eric, who's always a helpful sort of, like, deus ex machina plot point,
yes,
like, literal deus ex machina. Anywho, so Eric tells them that the Visser III is going to be taken to the site where they're prepping this facility that I guess will launch, beam, I don't know, the site where they'll do
beam.
The thing. Yeah, they'll do the thing. HQ. Visser III is meant to be taken there, and for the Animorphs to go with him, they will have to basically stow away on Visser III and get on board the ship and travel with him. It seems like they should have predicted the probability that, which is what ended up happening, that once they got on board the ship, the bug fighter, that it was longer than 2 hours to fly there. They didn't know that. They didn't know how long it would be. It was probably going to be longer than 2 hours to fly there.
Guys, come on. You live in the United States. Most places are longer than 2 hours by plane.
Yeah.
And that's the U.S., which they're not going to be building this thing there because nowhere is remote enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to shake them.
Yeah, it was sort of astonishing how much they, like, didn't seem to have thought about that. Like, they acted like it was a big, like, big piece of bad news, which it was,
maybe,
but it wasn't
be
a
an
surprise.
Hour and a half flight. Like, guys, no.
No. Yeah. So they stowed away as fleas on Visser III, which is just hilarious in a lot of ways, because it allowed for Visser III to, like, scratch his butt and stuff, and it's always funny when, like, mass-murdering supervillains scratch their butts. It is in Marco books. So, yeah, and then they had to figure out, you know, how to demorph and remorph on board this ship. And so that's, like, part of how this structure is sort of odd, is that their longer goal, there's a lot of obstacles that get thrown up in the middle, and, like, this was one of them. Like, how do they get out of Visser III's bunk and find a place to morph and remorph in their, like, are they fleas or flies? I guess they're flies. So they find a way. It's pretty clever what they do. They get Axe to imitate Visser III using thought speak and to send his voice out into the hallway to summon guards to come in and, like, barge in on Visser III while he's probably, like, singing into a hairbrush in the mirror or something. And so
Ice Ice Baby.
Exactly. So, yeah, so Visser III naturally gets very angry, and they do it 3 times and are able to sneak out the door the last time and find their way to the storage bay per Axe's directions. And when they're there, they demorph and they remorph into their fighting positions because they figure, like, if we're going to go down, we are going to go down swinging. And while they're there, they see in the storage facility these, like, canisters holding creatures in viscous fluid. I like to think in the style of Luke at the beginning of Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, they're Bacta.
Yes!
I mean, well, functionally, probably, because it keeps them alive, right?
I think so. A really, really, really cold Bacta. So, yeah, and Axe realizes that they're Venber, which are an alien species. This is where it does get interesting. An alien species that went extinct and that the Yurks have somehow brought back by using, kind of like Jurassic Park, using other, it's questioned, using other DNA to, like, fill in the sequence. And theoretically human DNA, which is really creepy.
I really liked that.
Yeah.
You know, being a Jurassic Park fan. It's like,
yes.
Did you guys not watch any Earth films before you decided to do this?
They did not see Jurassic Park. They did not know that life finds a way.
Seriously, life is finding a way in the Arctic right now.
I just want,
there's,
like,
aliens there.
I want Dr. Ian Malcolm to have a conversation with Visser III.
He wouldn't even be scared.
No, he would be perplexed that Visser III was not grasping, like, the principles he was trying to explain to him. And he would just, like, push his glasses up his nose and be like, but I don't think you're really understanding what I'm telling you here.
Can I please, please, dear followers, please, someone draw this for me.
Oh, please, yes. We beg of you. Any Jurassic Park Animorph crossover fans, there have to be many of you. Because you've all got flawless taste. Exactly. The thing with the Venbers, though, turned out that they're somehow programmed, which I feel like was that... I wasn't super clear. I'll just go ahead and say I wasn't super clear then on what the result was in terms of how they, like, got the Venbers. Like, are they... How are they controlled then? Like, are they... They acted like... Axe was like, oh, it makes so much sense. And I was like, can you share with the class? Because, like, I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't remember either. I'm going to look at the passage, actually.
Okay.
Because they were, like, wiped out by the Five. Who are the Five?
I don't know about five. There's so much mythology. Yeah, so I'll go ahead and fill in on the backstory. So the Venber were wiped out by the Five, which were, like, an ancient, primitive race of people or species of people. And they discovered that if you melted Venber, that the melted goo of their bodies was good for something like engines, like computers, some sort of like technological advancement.
Yeah, they like basically made them into a chip.
Yeah, which is like kind of a dick move. So to put it lightly, and that's another thing where like it does connect to, you know, the larger themes and stuff like that of the Animorphs in terms of the Yerks and parasites and sort of tales and stories of species conquering other species for, like, their own personal gain and without sort of any regard for humanity, as it were, although I don't know if you can really use that word amongst aliens. What ends up happening to the kids, to our dear kids, they find another way to get out of this disaster, which I do appreciate that, like, in the way that this story is structured, it does put, like, the writing does paint them into a corner and forces them to find a solution and the way out of it, which I think is, like, you know, realistic and believable, and I like that the stakes are sort of followed through on. And so while they're in the storage bay, they realize that there should be some sort of escape hatch to the exterior. There's, like, three hatches that open of four, and so they figure that since the fourth one is closed, it probably leads to the outside, and they're like, nope, don't open that one! So... they create a diversion by which, really, just Rachel, like, body slams Visser 3. And
you know, she was waiting for an opportunity to do
God
that.
Bless. Rachel was, like, A+ in this book, which Rachel is A+ in any book. Let's be real here. But so, she body slams Visser 3, and Marco, since he has the gorilla opposable thumbs, starts smashing and beating, like, a control pad to be able to open the door. Oh no, Rachel, excuse me, I need to back that up. Rachel is not the one who body slams Visser 3. Rachel body slams the canisters.
Oh, yeah, right, she lets the member out.
Yes. Somebody else body slams Visser 3, and they deserve kudos as well. I'm pretty sure it's Jake and somebody. Axe? Tobias, too? I don't know, anybody. All hands on deck.
Literally everyone attacks Visser 3.
Yeah, exactly. They're all gonna need it. So, Rachel body slams the canister, in order to, like, create chaos. And the liquid, we're just going to call it Bacta, inside, we're going to make a crossover universe here. We're crossing Star over Jurassic Star Park, Wars. Star Wars, and Animorphs. I mean, why wouldn't you? So the liquid inside spills out, and it's freezing, and it is freezing in even, like, a chemical way that turns, like, the Horcrux to stone, or ice, icy stone, paralyzes them. Cassie, actually, and this was another thing that was, like, a really harrowing thing that just happened kind of in, like, a little sidebar. It was, like, a little paragraph, and it was like, oh, no, that's really awful, but it kind of went by quickly. Was Cassie gets knocked out. She is thrown. Marco sees her be thrown by one of the Horcruxes, and they get the door open, and they're all bailing, and before they leave, Rachel turns back and heads into the mist of weird stuff. And picks up Cassie and leaves behind a foot because it freezes her foot. Which, I mean, we just go like, oh, Cassie and Rachel feels like... And they jump out. They're only like 20 feet in the air, which is absurd. Like, I thought they were going to have to like morph human and then morph bird again as they're like spiraling through the air down to earth. No, they're like 20 feet up. They like land on their backs and it's like, oh, let's like demorph. So it turns out they're in the Arctic, which is not great news because they don't really have any cold weather morphs, least of all Tobias and Axe. And so literally they just start walking. Like, that's the bulk of the book is them walking in the freezing cold weather and trying to figure out how to survive, which I do appreciate the reality of that.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it would be like.
Yeah.
At least they do have wolves, which...
They do have wolves.
Kind of can exist in some parts of the Arctic.
Yes.
Apparently not where they are.
No. But, oh. I mean, the fact they have thick fur, and that'll, like, that'll, you know, do them. Tobias and Axe morph fleas and then hide out on everyone's bodies. And eventually, there. And then another thing, tiny thing that gets brought up that's interesting is that they're hungry. That they're wolves and they're hungry and they have no sort of resources. And they saw a polar bear kill a seal and then leave a lot of the meat. And do they eat it? It plays out kind of in the reverse of what we would expect in terms of, like, we would expect it a certain way, and so would Marco, and that's sort of how, like, the conflict happened. Because you would expect Rachel and Marco to sort of bottom line it and say, look, this is the situation, this is what we have to do in order to survive. And you would expect Jake to say, okay, let's stop and talk about it, or let's just, like, get it over with. And then you would expect Cassie and or Tobias to raise, like, ethical issues of, like, the animal kingdom. So, and then Axe to, like, not understand anything. So Marco expects that to happen, and he sort of beats Cassie to the punch and makes kind of like a snide remark, or maybe not even a snide remark, he just remarks about her, about him assuming that she would be against eating this seal. And she kind of gets in his face a little bit about that she doesn't, that she, you know, she's with everybody else, that they are part of this, like, food chain now. It's already been killed. They need to survive. Like, and the one thing that she said that was really, like, powerful was, like, do you think that I would put, like, an animal's life over any of yours? Like, any of you guys' lives? Which was made me go, like, oh, like, no, of course not.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's, like, it's always a running thing. Cassie's, like, the tree hugger, and she's an animal nut, and, you know, in book 18 we see her... You know, Marco makes that horrible crack about her, like, you know, when after she quits, and now, you know, she just is going to spend all her time with her animals, and then, of course, you know, that ends up not being the case. So it's just, like, that finally gets addressed. It's like, no, you can care about a thing and care about something else more.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously. And I think Cassie, in her... She doesn't blindly love animals, like, and because she also has the respect... for nature, which, like, Tobias has, and part of that is the, like, predator-prey dichotomy, and, like, there's really not an easy way to negotiate that, and at the end of the day, it really does come down to survival of the fittest and survival, like, of your loved ones kind of thing, and so she was, like, she was on board with eating that seal. I mean, it's not, like, anything any of them wanted to do, but... The situation was such
nobody
that they needed to.
Seal.
No, well, it wasn't, and then it made it worse because it was like the mom seal, and then the babies came out, and I thought it was funny, not funny. That's a terrible way to describe that. I thought it was like notable as well that Rachel kind of says like, well, like maybe they'll make it, and Cassie was like, they won't make it. And it was just like, oh. But then she said they'll feed somebody else who's trying to survive and stay warm, and I was just like, yeah. I'm bummed out about the animal world now.
Yeah, I mean, nobody can say that, like, Cassie is, like, love and light and cute fuzzies. And
no.
Like, from the get-go, she's always, one of her earliest monologues, like, in one of her viewpoint books is about how a color of nature is red, not green.
Yeah.
Like, this is, you know, come on, guys. I don't know how you managed to ignore this and, like, cast her as some, like, peace, love, hippie thing. That's really not the case.
Yeah, I love her a lot. And it makes her dynamic with Rachel really interesting because it creates that sort of similarity and difference, like tension, that sort of is pushing them together and pulling them apart the entire way through the series, which is really, really compelling and like sad.
Things to look forward to.
Things we'll talk about in every podcast until the end of time.
Yes. That's a promise.
Yes. So they eat the seal. And question, could they acquire the DNA of a dead animal?
In theory?
Right.
I mean, it's still in existence. It's still a carbon life form with DNA. I never thought about that. like, I mean, DNA doesn't cease to, I mean, that's how you do things with bones, like, you know.
That's how criminology works these days.
Yeah, you don't need to be alive to have DNA, like, this was not addressed in the Science of Animorphs post on the Toast. And now I'm going to need to bring it up.
And it was around this time that they met Derek, who is a random Inuit, who I was, like, hoping would maybe be...
You're like their auxiliary in the
right?
Arctic.
I wish it to be so.
Yeah, form a closer bond. After you leave, like, maybe try to find him on the internet.
And Google him, make sure he's not a David.
You know, keep an eye out for crazy human-alien hybrids that may or may not be running around.
Right? But set up a Google alert for that.
What's going on up there?
And so with Derek's sort of help, he doesn't really help that much though. They acquire a polar bear, which that's what Rachel attacks. Rachel just like attacks a polar bear as a grizzly bear.
She probably wants to because when Cassie is like explaining what polar bears are to Axe, she's like, "Oh, it's the largest land predator," and Rachel's like. Excuse me?
I'm sorry, what now?
I was under the impression that the grizzly was the largest land predator.
Basically, that I was the largest land predator.
Yeah, she's very affronted to learn that no, in fact, it's the polar bear.
Mm.
So, obviously, now she has a really good reason to attack one.
What a goober. So, yes. So they acquire the polar bear, and then now that they finally... The bulk of this book is just literally figuring out a way to survive in the extreme cold, and now that they have finally achieved that as polar bears, because they even, like... I'm gonna have to back it up a little bit. They spend the night. They spend the night in like an ice cave, like morphing and huddling for warmth, and like, and their morphing outfits are like spandex. Like this is really, it's not an ideal time. They don't eat. They're not really sleeping. Like they are hardcore pushed to their limits, and it's just because of like nature, which is interesting that it's not like the aliens that are doing it to them. It's nature.
Earth will kill you too.
Yes, exactly. Doesn't that make you feel better?
What are we defending you for anyway, Earth?
Kind of. Yeah. So they get their polar bear morphs, and now that they're actually equipped to, like, handle the cold, they can formulate their plan on how to attack the base, which is literally just to walk in a straight line as polar bears to the base. This all happens so quickly. And very sort of
unceremonious. No one is going to notice a single file line of polar bears.
No, yeah, like, it happens quickly and unceremoniously. They walk in a single file line, they just start smacking around Venber, and they hijack a bug fighter, and then when the blade ship pursues them, they set it to self-destruct, and they jump out as birds, and they fly home! And it takes them, like, 2 days to fly home!
I feel like it would probably take longer than that.
I think so, too.
Because, I mean... As has been noted in various other books, does it state what bird morph they're using? They really only have, like, seagulls and birds of prey, right?
I'm pretty sure they were just in their standard birds of prey morph.
Yeah, because, like, those are not power birds. Like, in book 3, Tobias is like, there were geese. Now, geese can fly, man. Let me tell you about geese. But, obviously, they're not geese.
They should have acquired geese. They had time. Like, it would have been worth it in the long run to find a goose and, like, acquire it.
I mean, they were probably in Canada.
Probably.
Or somewhere near Canadian geese.
Maybe, yeah.
Anyway, that is not at all the point.
But it should have been part of the point. Because it was like a paragraph. It's like, oh, and then we flew home. It took us 2 days. And I was like, what did you eat? Like, how did you manage? Like, come on. There's more story here.
There was sort of, like you said, the structure was kind of weird, like...
Super weird.
Most of the actual significant points go by pretty quickly, like, we literally flew home from the Arctic to California.
Seriously. I did appreciate, like, the way, sort of plot-wise, that they were pushed to, like, the extreme of what really would happen and you know, created a sort of a scrappy way to get out of it every time. Like, I did appreciate that. And they did ultimately complete the mission. Once they got into Bugfighter, then, you know, Marco took the weapons controller and they just blew up the whole place. Of course, they also assumed that some Venber were left, because they also see Venber melting. Like, when they're getting in the Bugfighter, is it literally just that it was a warmer room than where they were? Like, it was just too warm.
When, like, the temperature is above freezing. Basically.
Yeah, it was too warm and they just melted. And it was like, oh... This is, again, a really unceremonious way for these people, like, these creatures to just sort of, like, meh. So, And they make it home, and then Marco takes a hot shower. That's the book.
Yep, that is the book.
We are definitely going to read number 26 next, which is called The Attack, and features Jake morphing into a tiger. Do you know what happens in this book? And what's really dumb is I know this.
Oh, I can't remember it at all. Although that's a signature morph.
It is a signature morph. It's weird that's getting brought out now in book 26. This is when Jake and Cassie first kiss, everybody. It is.
I don't remember that at all.
I do. I remember it. My romance-loving, like, teenage heart. I remember this.
Yo, man, let's get out of here. Word to your mother.
So anyway, we hope you stayed warm for this this discussion of The Extreme, number 25. It was kind of an odd little sojourn through Snowtown, but it had its moments. It had some good stuff in it. And we will return for The Attack with Jake. See you then.